I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
Marvelous!
This is Talk Is Jericho.
Talk Is Jericho,
starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. This is the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. Yeah! The remedy for boredom has arrived. And we are so happy to have you here with us this week. So many cool things going on. The Oscars. Awesome to see Jared Leto win an Oscar. Not only did he win an Oscar, but he's also the lead singer of 30 Seconds for Mars, who 30 Seconds to Mars, who will probably be selling out the Hollywood Bowl. So he's winning an Oscar, and he's having sellout arena shows worldwide, proving that you can be very successful in two separate fields. He's an inspiration to me. And I'm really excited to see him win. I'm really behind on all my movie watching ventures, though. It's like I realized that there was probably like 10 movies that I wanted to see from last night. And usually I'm not into like the whole Oscar Academy winning movies, but I want to see Nebraska. I want to see Dallas Buyers Club. I want to see what else am I into? Wolf of Wall Street. Never checked that one out yet. I mean, there's a lot of movies I got to check out. So that is going to be – actually, the other night I was going to watch Nebraska because it's on pay-per-view now. But instead I watched Kingdom of the Spiders starring William Shatner from 1977 for probably like the fifth time. And it's just the worst movie ever, but it's Shatner. And I text about it too. I was like, yeah, I'm watching, you know, Kingdom of the Spiders with William Shatner and he's awesome. And he texts me back. He's like, LOL. And I was like, you know, it's cool though, man. The movie's great. And plus you got to make out with a blonde chick. And he's like, oh, that's so precious. So I'm assuming that if you're 80, precious means funny. But yeah, I was talking to William Shatner, Bill Shatner, on the Twitter. So I got that going for me. So yeah, so I need to get caught up on my movies. Now, another thing that's funny too, I've been doing a lot of signings over the country for auto shows. I just did one this weekend in Chicago. I've got Detroit next week, et cetera, et cetera. And people come up to me and they'll say, like, you know, when are you coming back to the WWE? Or, you know, we really liked you in the WWE. We liked your last run. But we hated the fact that all you did was lose and put people over. Why did you lose all the time? Lose. And I was like, you know, it doesn't really matter losing or winning. You know, it's kind of just it's more about the performance and having a great match. But a lot of people think that it's all about winning and losing. Well, it's funny. I subscribe to the Wrestling Observer newsletter with my buddy Dave Meltzer, who does it. Actually, I subscribed for like 3 or 4 years, and then for the last, I think, 15, he just sends them to me. So I read them. It's always good to kind of read what's going on in business and stuff. And I happen to get this list of 2013 WWE win-loss records compiled by Chris Harrington. So Chris, who obviously is an uber wrestling fan and maybe has a lot of time on his hands, put together a whole list of the wins and losses. So I was curious, just how many wins and losses did I have last year when I was accused of just losing all the time? Well, check it out. Here it is. I actually have it right here. Chris Jericho, in singles matches, 26 wins, 20 losses, and one tie. Tag matches, 8 wins, 2 losses. Overall, 34 wins, 22 losses, and one tie. That's an average of a 600% winning average, 0.605 winning. If I was a baseball player, I would be like making more money than A-Rod if I had a 600 batting average, right? So for everybody who says, oh, Jericho just lost when he came back. No, I didn't. I only lost 22 matches and won 34 out of 57 total matches. It's funny, when I was first starting out wrestling, I used to actually keep my own win-loss records. And it was like, everybody was so like, oh, you can't be, what are you, Mark? You keep track of your wins and losses? And I was like, no, but of course I was. I think probably everybody was when you first start out, because wins and losses mean so much more when you're first starting out. But then after a while, you realize it doesn't really matter. But let's see. Poor Oksana, 2 wins, 83 losses for a 0.024 win-loss record. Now, that's a horrible batting average. Let's look through. Oh, Daniel Bryan, 181 wins, 35 losses, and 5 ties. That's 830% winning percentage. So he's doing really good. Camacho, 0% winning. He lost 0 out of 13 matches. So not a good year for old Camacho. Let's see who else. Oh, Cena, 0.952 winning percentage. He only lost 6 matches last year in 2013 out of 142 matches. That's a winner. That's a winner. I'm not sure if I've ever beaten John Cena before. I know I wrestled him countless times, but I think I lost every single one of them. If you can remember a time that I beat John Cena, let me know. On the Twitter, at Talk is Jericho. Let's see who else did good. Here's a good one. Kane, 0.811, 800 batting average, 107 wins, 25 losses. CM Punk, he had 700 winning average, not bad. Just trying to see who else did really, really good. I think Cena's obviously the best one. Sheamus, 800 batting average, 104 wins, 21 losses, and 5 ties. Bray Wyatt, 44 wins and 10 losses. He's at an 815. So there's some good guys here. Guys had a good year winning lots of matches. But the biggest loser, I think, was Oksana. Well, Camacho at 0, but Oksana. Kurt Hawkins, 0.022. He wouldn't be making the squad with that type of batting average. So my question is, like I said, who put together this list? This Chris Harrington, my goodness, that is a lot of information. He must have gotten a list or, God forbid, watched every single match. Well, you couldn't have watched a house show. So he went back online or whatever, kept a list of every show and compiled this record. So the most matches in 2013 was Daniel Bryan, had 227. Then Dean Ambrose, Randy Orton, Seth Rollins, and Roman Reigns. Okay. Most times opposing each other, Daniel Bryan versus Seth Rollins, 75 times. Holy smokes, that's a lot. Those guys must have had it down pat. Daniel Bryan versus Roman Reigns, 74 times. Daniel Bryan versus Dean Ambrose, 79 times. So Daniel Bryan was against the Shield a lot last year. Caitlin and Tamina Snuka, 57 matches. Cena versus Ryback, 46 matches. So there's quite a few of these, lots of information. This guy should be working for Major League Baseball or something along those lines. I don't think I could watch that many matches or compile that much of a list. I have no problem compiling my own list of matches, which I have kept a list of every match that I've ever had for my very first one, which was October 2nd, 1990, all the way up until my last match, which was July 13th, 2013. And I believe the list is about 2,843 or 44, something like that. I'll have to go back and check on it. But I kept a list. It used to be the number of what number match it was, and then who it was against, and where it was, what the finish was, my rating of the match, the amount of people I thought were there, and the amount of money I made. So I kept a big, long list of all these things. And then as time went by, I stopped dropping the amount of people, because you're just guessing, you know. And then the amount of money that I made, because then when you actually started making some money, I didn't really have to, you know, you didn't have to go match by match. But in the early days, like, you know, $50, made $50, or $150, or I made $850, what a windfall. But I still kept the list, and the list is still number of the match, name, where it is, who it's against, and the rating system. And the rating system for me would be 5 stars, would be the best match ever. And I think that I might actually have one or two matches listed as 5 stars. And this is not what other people think. It's what I think. Because when you come out of the match, you know deep down inside whether it was a great gig or a so-so gig or, you know, a shitty one or whatever. And then I would think back on it. Okay, this one was 2 stars, this was 3 stars. And if it was just kind of an average match that I thought was good but not great, I'd give it 3 stars. But if it was four stars or over, and I remember back in 95, I was making this big scrapbook. I'd only been wrestling for 5 years or so. And I actually made a list of, okay, here's my five-star matches. Here's my four-and-a-half-star matches. You know, matches won, matches lost, matches in Japan, matches in Mexico. I had it all. And then I just gave up. I just could not keep track. And actually, on my new book that is coming out October 13th, I will. I was going to actually include that list in the back of it, like as an appendix, but I ran out of space. I had so much to write about. So if I ever do a fourth book, at the end of it, I'll have to put the list of all of my matches for anybody that cares. Like, I don't know if anybody would care to read through all of them, but I have them, and I've never changed it from the paper to a computer. So if there was like a fire in my house or my dog peed on it or something like that, I would lose this information. Like the first page that I have. The first match that I have written is literally on the piece of paper that I wrote it on in 1990. So it's all crumpled up and all that sort of stuff. It might even be a little bit green at this point in time. But it's like, you know, people might pay a lot for that, eh? I could put it up on eBay and make a couple bucks if things ever go bad. But there you go. Chris Jericho's win-loss record in 2013, 26-20-1. Actually, overall, 34-22-1. 605 winning percentage. So I don't want to hear it anymore about how all I did last year was lose. Okay? I might have lost all the big matches, but my overall record's pretty darn good. So step off, people. All right. This is your podcast. This is the people's podcast. So if you have any comments on anything that I say, hit me up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho. We got Rob Van Dam coming up.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
On the line, one of the most unique characters I've ever met in my wrestling career and one of my favorites to wrestle, Rob Van Dam, RVD. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Doing great, man. It's not just an image, man. I feel as good as I look.
Well, since it's radio, you're looking great today, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Exceptionally well today.
You know, it's the last time I saw you was at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. After we had the first match we'd had in, I think, 10 years or so. And it's funny because a lot of fans, a lot of people, everyone besides the WWE actually, said that the match was one of their favorites of the year, one of the best matches of the year. And it was just kind of a nice way for me. It was my last night and your first night.
True. Yep. I still see on Twitter every day, I see somebody, if not several people, bitching that it should have got a Slammy or Match of the Year or something.
Something.
So, yeah, the fans really liked it.
Yeah, it was funny, too, because, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, we worked each other tons of times over the years, but it had been about 10 years. But once we got in there, it was just like, you know, it's like riding the proverbial bike. You never forget each other's, you know, move sets and chemistry after all that time.
Yeah, Chris, I enjoyed that match, too. It was a good way to come in and to see a New York City for the first time in a long time for me. The way that you're describing it reminds me of the first time I wrestled Sabu in ECW. We just went out there and did our thing, and at that time, for sure, I'd wrestled Sabu and probably still have wrestled him more than anybody else in my career since I was wrestling him before I had my first match because he was, you know, helping train me. And so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was funny because even you know, people that know how the WWE works, especially Raw, is the time is very regimented on the show. And right before we went out, something had gone wrong or ran short or ran long. And I remember they gave us 8 extra minutes, about 30 seconds before we went out there, and an extra commercial break, too, which when you're putting together a match, the commercial break is always very important. They're very meticulous about that. They want the commercial break to be a certain spot, and we just made everything up, including the breaks. I always took great pride in that. It was fun.
It can be fun for the artist or frustrating for the worker, usually a combination of both.
How was your let's talk about that. How was your last run in the WWE, or your most recent run in the WWE? And what was the background in making you decide to come back after so many years?
Yeah, well, it was awesome. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed with, and we might get back to this, but I was impressed with the work rate standard, how much higher it was than when I left. Mm-hmm. When I was there before, there was room for guys that sucked. You know, guys that would get pushed, fans would bitch, we would bitch, some of us would have to put them over, and then they realize that doesn't work, they get rid of them, and then we're left, you know, with
right.
broken pieces to pick up. And I don't want to start naming names, but there were several. There was just room for that then. Now there's not. Everybody knew what they were doing in that ring on a whole new level, and I was really happy to see that, and I hope that trickles down everywhere. It seems like it may be, because I was at Booker T's Reality of Wrestling a few weeks ago in Houston, and I thought, wow, man, I can't believe this is an independent show. All these guys are just, you know, really out there doing it right, and they know what, you know, they know what they're doing. So it was awesome. So what happened was I had a 3-year contract with TNA.
Mm-hmm.
So the contract was coming up. I was letting it come up without talking to them. Not because I wanted to go anywhere else, but because I was my pay and my deal was such that I had a number of matches that I would work in a year. Mm-hmm. If I worked over that, then they had to pay me over that. I was collecting overtime, and I didn't want to bring it to a point, you know, where they would stop booking me, because I was still, you know, enjoying collecting the extra. So I let my deal run out, and I was still working, and then boom, it ran out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I get a phone call. They want to know if I want to resign. We talked about every single term. I had a deal on the table that I was really happy with.
Mm-hmm.
I was really happy with the deal that I had when I was there, you know, and this was, you know, a good thing. I was looking forward to it. But the only thing we didn't have was a starting date, and then they started just slacking and, you know, saying they're going to call me on Friday, and then I wouldn't hear from them. And then, you know, like a week or two would go by, and then I'd get a call. Oh, I don't know what's taking so long. It's not me. It's this person. Let me get back. And I just really, I got to a point where I was offended, you know, and like it struck my ego, and, you know. So I was just, you know, like, well, screw them, you know. And I went to the Hall of Fame to see Booker T get inducted. I knew that would kick a bunch of rumors out there that I'd be coming back, but that wasn't the situation at all. I hadn't seen hardly anybody in years, and I got there so late I didn't even get to talk to most people. Like, I got there right when I got there, they were like, "Hey, we need to rush you out there to the seats." And I was like, you know, I got a couple pictures real quick. They got out there on the internet, but I didn't really get to see anybody. And it was a little time later that I was like, you know, I'm not sure if this thing is happening with TNA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there seemed to be plenty of reasons to maybe look into WWE and see if there's an opportunity there. When I left, by the way, back in 2006, they wanted me to re-sign and just take some time off and come right back. And I said, I'm so burnt out. I can't do that. I'll be counting the minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't know exactly how many days till I got to come back. I don't know how long it's going to take me to clear my head and get spiritually balanced. I need to have an indefinite, you know, disconnection from here. And when I'm ready, I'll come back. I had no idea it was going to be 6 or 7 years till I was ready to come back. But when I came back, I was ready, dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who was it that you were dealing with at TNA at this point? Who was it? Is it Terry Taylor now, or?
No, he's been gone for quite
some
time.
Oh, sorry.
As a matter of fact, I think he works for...
he does. WWE, yeah. He works for WWE.
Yeah, so now I don't even know. I mean, it's been a year, you know what I mean? And at that time, Bruce Pritchard was the man on top, and they had designated Al Snow to be the middleman to talk to me.
Gotcha.
And, you know, the first phone call that he gave me, when Rob, you're a contractor now, he was like, you know, this is kind of awkward for me. I don't know why they wanted me to middleman this, but they want to know if you're interested in re-signing. And it was awkward, you know, and when I got offended, Part of the offense was on ale, you know, which there's no long-term hard feelings there. But for a minute, you know, there I was like, screw him, you know. I mean, just I've known ale since like...
Right, forever.
90. I met him in 1990. No, 89. Yeah, 90s. Anyway, but I was like, you know, I mean, if I tell, hey, Chris, you know, I'm going to find out something, you know, I apologize. I'll give you a call Friday. I'm going to talk to so-and-so, and then you don't hear from me in 2 weeks. I don't know. I'm kind of being an asshole, yeah. Perspectively. But anyway, I get it. It's definitely not on him. But for a minute, I was, you know, when I decided to reach out to WWE, I was kind of like offended by everybody, mm-hmm. by Dixie, which who knows what kind of information goes all the way to the top. You know, she could have been telling her they were talking to me when they were or whatever. I don't know. But still, I felt like, wait a second. Does she not notice? Mm-hmm. I haven't been on her TV in like 6 weeks.
Well, I mean, you mentioned, though, that when you left in 2006, WWE wanted you to resign, but you needed some time away. What was it that made you sign with TNA instead of WWE when you were ready to come back to full-time working?
Well, so I took 3 years off. When I first left WWE, I was so burnt out because I'd been burnt out for much of my run there, you know, and I've been asking for time off, not getting it, getting further burnt out, finding ways to keep going for so long that when my contract ran out, because, you know, I'm not one of these guys that walks out in the middle of their contract, you know, I don't know how, whatever, everyone handles their business differently, but yeah. I finished the deal. And then I was just like, okay, you know, I fulfilled my obligations. I don't care if I ever step on an airplane again. Mm-hmm. I don't care if I ever step in the ring again. And that's how I felt at that time. And about 6-7 months went by, and then I got this really tempting offer. You know, I've been turning down all these offers, and this one guy who became a good friend of mine, Axel, in Portugal, he's talking to one of my friends that actually middlemanned this, you know, and then ended up calling me and saying, hey, dude, you're going to Portugal. I go, what? Dude, come on. You know the deal. I don't want to go anywhere. Big money, upfront 100%, 2 first-class tickets, you know, so me and my wife can go on a vacation, put us up in a nice hotel, stay on them, have a vacation there an extra 4 or 5 days, sold it to the wife first. I put the boots back on. Once I had the boots back on, I went about 3 years wrestling exclusively overseas. I only did one shot in the States, and that was 30 minutes up the road at the Wrestle Reunion, which also was a sweet payday, 100% up front. And so I got new standards then. And you know, what it was worth to me wasn't the same as what it would be worth to most bookers or promoters. So I had, you know, a very selective career going on. And then with TNA, it was mostly just an extension of that. It was a deal with, I'll do so many matches for so much money. And it was a real good deal. And, of mm-hmm. course, they had TV. It was cool to get on TV. But mostly, dude, it was one of the best. Actually, all along my career, perspectively, I've always had a better deal than I had before. Mm-hmm. And for this one, it was a 3-year deal, and at first, every 2 weeks, I was taking a direct flight from LAX to Orlando. I'd get there, I'd take a red eye, I'd get there Monday morning, we'd do TV Monday, we'd do TV Tuesday. My parents lived near there, so it was cool. I was able to visit them, boom, I'd jet back home, I'd be off for 2 weeks. It was a sweet deal.
Very stress-free.
Well, as much as you could have anyway. I mean, for normal people, even just taking a flight or just going through the airport once is a lot of work. So for us, we're used to handling so much stress anyway. Yeah, but this was the most, you know, relaxed, and it felt really appreciative to have me down there. You know, it was Universal Studios, so if I did get a little stressed out over whatever, you know, because I can get overwhelmed easy. You know, I spent the whole 3 years sitting in my car in the parking lot. if everybody wants a piece of me, I get overwhelmed. You know, when you get time, we need to do a promo over here. Hey, we're doing a photo shoot for this over here. Hey, we got to do a walkthrough over here. You got so-and-so wants to talk to you. I'll get overwhelmed. I always have, you know. That's work.
Yeah.
Fans don't realize, but that's work, man. But Universal Studios, if I did get stressed out, I'd take a walk, I'd go ride the Spider-Man ride.
You know, it's interesting what you just said, too. It's funny because you are right. For a normal person, flying a red-eye coast to coast on a weekly basis, it messes them up because there's the time change, just you know, traveling overnight. For us, like I said, that's a sweet deal, man. We live in a different world than the majority of normal people, quote unquote.
Oh, absolutely. That's, of course, that's why they're fascinated by our lifestyle. And we look at other, you know, A-list celebrities the same way. I mean, how can we not look at George Clooney and go, man, the life that guy must have, you know, private jets, yachts, his pick of all the gorgeous women, the stacks of money under his pillow, you know, just to put his head up. But, you know, that's like, we're a small group, you know?
Yeah.
And that's,
It is a small world.
People forget too, by the way, when they start talking about it. Wrestlers need to be insured, which I don't want to open up a whole can of worms here, but we're a small group. We're like one company, maybe two. We're not like, something that, yeah, that's offered out there for kids, you know, on the, in college or on your, you know, fill this out at school. When I grow up, I want to be a fireman, a principal, a pro wrestler. Well, there it is. I'll check that box. It's not on there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, it is a small world, like you said, and there's only a certain amount of really quality performers. You spent 3 years in TNA. Who were some of the best guys that you like to work with there?
Oh man, let's see. Samoa Joe. I like the matches with Abyss very much.
Okay, yeah.
They were usually hardcore, which is what I like. Jeff Hardy. You know, wish I could have wrestled with him more.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you wrestle with Angle at all when you were there?
Yeah, Angle, yeah, AJ's really good. I kind of regret that we didn't have, like, classic matches that we could have, but there was a lot of factors going into that, I think, with timing and everything, but he's really good. They got a lot of guys that I think could easily, you know, step up if they wanted to, but a lot of them don't look at that as stepping up, meaning going, you know, to the dub, but a lot of them, you know how it is, like, after a while, you start... Your priorities are different, and you care about the art so much, you know. I mean, I've heard backyard kids. I don't ever want to leave the backyard. You know, this is what I do.
Yeah.
You know, all right. But you kind of owe it to yourself to get the most long-term that you can out of your efforts.
Well, I mean, and you mentioned earlier about some of the guys that you worked in WWE that you'd never worked before. Who were some of the guys you enjoyed being in the ring with when you came back this time?
Everybody. I enjoyed being in the ring with everybody, you know, and mostly I was doing an angle with Alberto Del Rio.
He's good, isn't he? I liked working with him.
Yeah, before I went there, when I turned the TV on, I was like, I better watch this and try to familiarize myself with these guys. Alberto Del Rio stood out. I liked his style and also Antonio Cesaro.
Yeah, he's great too, man. He's one of those guys that makes me laugh because I think early on in his WWE career, Vince gave him the stamp of no personality or whatever it is, and they kind of stuck him in a role. But he is going to be such a huge star there, and they're already kind of giving him a little bit of a shot because that guy's a great worker.
I don't hear anybody ever say anything different either. And behind the curtains, he's known as being one of the strongest wrestlers in the dressing room, which you might not guess as a fan when you're looking at, you know, Mark Henry and Ryback and all these guys. But everyone is super impressed with his natural strength. And Regal was telling me one day that Cesaro. That he can snatch a universal barbell with a 45-pound plate on each side with one hand in the middle and pick it up off the ground straight up over his head without collars on it.
Insane, right? Yeah, I remember being in the ring and you'd be like, I want to pick you up and then I'll give you a gut-wrench suplex and don't do anything. So you'd be on the ground, he would just pick me up, like literally like I pick up my son and just pitch me across the ring. And, you know, we're about the same height, but he's just got that crazy core strength to him, like the just like a monster, you know?
Yeah, I've seen him do it to the biggest guys there.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny that, you know, talking about WWE, you actually appeared in the WWE when you were a teenager with the Million Dollar Man in one of his Million Dollar Man skits. I had forgotten about this. And when I did some research before this interview, because, you know, I'm pretty professional nowadays. How the hell did that happen? And tell me the story about that.
So I'm a fan at this point, and this is one of my first shows. You know, I don't know what number, but I'd only been to, you know, a few shows. I was making the rounds when they'd come to Battle Creek, Lansing, where at Grand Rapids, wherever somebody would take me. And my Anyway, so this was Battle Creek, and we're, you know, they're filming a vignette that's going to be on TV. It's a little different than normal house shows because they bring the cameras down. It's like a real big deal with the lights. And a lot of us kind of rushed down there towards the guardrail, and during his speech, he points towards me, although my best friend that was standing next to me swears he pointed at him, and I just jumped. But, yeah, I got in the ring and, you know, none of this was set up. Other people, you know, they have no idea where the boundaries are. But this was just, he said, I'm going to pay this kid to kiss my hot, stinky, sweaty foot. I was so excited. I already wanted to be a wrestler at that point. And I was just, you know, so enthralled by the whole situation when, you know, as soon as he goes, I'm going to give you $100. All right. I just grabbed it. You know, worst negotiator ever.
You negotiated for less money.
Yeah, and that's the whole deal. You know, you're supposed to say no, and 200, no, 300, no, 400. Well, yeah, I guess. I guess I'll do it for 400, yeah. You know, I mean, I knew that. I watched the show. I knew the deal, but I was so excited. I just, you know, I grabbed $100, I kissed his foot, I slapped Virgil on the shoulder. I was like, sweet. And I was so worried, by the way, in 2001 when I came to WWE, I was so worried that they were going to make a ridiculous angle out of that, you know, and say that, like, it's been, you know, for the last 20 years I've been training, and the reason I got into the business was to get my revenge on him for humiliating me. Or, doesn't that kind of sound like something that they would have done?
Oh, yeah, they make you like the, you'd have a foot fetish where you have to go kiss people's feet.
I was really concerned about this. So I wanted this under the cover. I didn't really talk about it. And then my dad exposed it when I did an interview for that before they were superstars. And my dad did, oh, Dad, you don't know what you did. Oh, they're going to make me look so. But they didn't, though.
I'm surprised that they didn't know that. I'm surprised that that didn't come out at some point during your earlier career.
Yeah, well, you know, and when it did finally come out, it was taken for what it is, you know, a part of actual real history, you know.
So you wanted to be a wrestler even at that young age. How did you?
Yeah, because my first show that I went to, someone put the idea in my head, and that was just a few shows before that.
Were you always very athletic and acrobatic?
No.
Really?
Which is acrobatic, maybe, but not. I was never recognized for it. I mean, I would watch Chop Saki movies, and I'd watch wrestling. I'd imitate the moves. I could run up a tree and do a backflip, stuff like that. I remember I used to be really skinny, and that allowed me to do certain stuff, too. Like on the playground, I could stand on the log house, and I could, like, jump up and turn sideways and fall between the space and the roof, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess I was entertaining people when I was, like, in first grade. But I didn't like school sports, you know. I joined wrestling because I wanted it to supplement my career, and I found out that they wanted everyone to be small, and I wanted to be big. You know, I'm 165 pounds telling people I'm going to be a professional wrestler, and the coach and everyone saying I could probably get down to 135. And
oh,
that was
wow.
The goal. Everyone, Michigan was in the state championships, too. Michigan was the state, but they were in the national championships. It was a real serious time. And so everybody was wearing a whole bunch of sweatshirts and you know, making themselves throw up. And, the best wrestlers in our school, you know, had the reputation for really, really being good. They were skinny and wiry. I was like, man, I don't want that. I want to put on 100 pounds. So I quit. And it was actually sometime in 96 when I read an interview that Taz did. It might even been 97 because we didn't get along for a long time. I don't know if he would have put me over or not there. But he did an interview where he said that he thought RVD was like the most athletically gifted wrestler in the business. And that's the first time that I remember that ever even crossing my mind. Like, me? Really? And it motivated me to really, you know, put a little effort into it.
Well, did you train, you know, you mentioned that you grew up in Battle Creek. Is that how you got in the business? Did you train with the Sheik and with Sabu?
I did. I graduated high school in 89. That same year, I took my first trip by myself, and I saved up. I had been saving money, and I went to Boston and visited Killer Kowalski's school. And this was after sending $5 to this wrestling magazine. I got this list of wrestling schools, and I corresponded, and I called, and I talked to anybody that would talk to me. Larry Sharp, Monster Factory, Johnny Hunter, North Carolina, anybody that would call me back. You know, I was asking asking the same questions, you know, tuition, duration, all that. And I was trying to save money to go see Kowalski, and I ended up finding out the Sheik, who had the same credibility from my perspective as Kowalski. The same, he trained a lot of guys. They were actually both trained by the same guy, Bert Ruby, as a matter of fact.
But, oh, wow.
Yeah, so anyway, the Sheik was 45 minutes from my parents' house. I wasn't going to have to go to Boston and try to figure out how to, you know, how to survive.
Yeah.
Year-old kids, so you know, no regrets.
How was he as a trainer? Did he actually get in the ring with you, or did he just kind of tell you what to do?
He rarely got in the ring with us. He was pretty old by that time, and when he would get in the ring, we didn't like it. We were very scared of him. He was intimidating. He never once suggested anything about anything being a work, ever.
Really?
Which I think is probably rare to get trained to be a pro wrestler and have, and he never once, I got trained the opposite of the way every fan would think that you get trained, but I never once had, this is a safe way to fall, this is, you know, how to do something to somebody without hurting them. Never once. He wanted us to be rough, grab each other, you know, like, it was all about protecting the business first. There was nothing about safety. Wrestlers were the tough guys. Get in there, grab them, squeeze them, you know, what are you doing? What, are you afraid you're going to hurt them? Grab them. And that's when he would get in the ring, when we weren't stiff enough. He'd get in there and he'd stretch us and you know, he'd really like fire us up. But, you know, we kind of, amongst ourselves, we kind of knew that we were all there for the same goal, you know, and we were, you know, at least we had common sense. But the way that we got trained was never one time what you and I would refer to as being smartened up.
What was who was your first match against?
Sabu. Well, no, I guess it wasn't. He was part of it, though. But my best friend growing up, his name was Dango Nguyen. He's a fireman in Atlanta now. But we actually, after I got into the wrestling school several months later, he joined. It wasn't, I say a school, but really there was like four of us. It was real private. We ate dinner with Sheik and his wife, swam in his pool. After it was real private, but and it was at his house, but it, sometimes it moved around. He and I we did everything together. We did the tough man contest together. We did martial arts contests together, tournaments. We both had the same dreams and goals. And, we, you know, both were trained by Cheek, and our first match was against each other. And they really, Sabu was like right outside the ring to jump in and end it before it got too long to protect, how green we were and stuff. Yeah, that's how it went.
Wow. That's, and what was his name? The guy that you had your first match with?
Dango. He does a lot of extra work on Walking Dead.
Oh, cool.
And some vampire thing right now. He's working his way up. But he actually still wrestles once in a while, and he actually even wrestled for ECW, and Paul offered him a job. And much to his regret, he had to turn it away due to, you know, just like normal people, you know, because the family, his wife didn't want him to do it and all that. He has since divorced his wife, so now he's kicking himself in the ass. But
hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. I am here with RVD. We're about to talk about Rob's time in ECW. Back in the early 90s, ECW was the place to be, but it wasn't exactly the easiest place to get in. How did you get into working there?
Sabu was already there.
Oh, okay.
And, he had been, for the longest time, he kept calling me. Did Paul call you? You're kidding me. He said he was going to call you Monday. All right, I'll call you back in a minute. That happened for the longest time, and I didn't care. I was totally like, whatever, because I had a sweet deal with All Japan at the time.
Oh, yeah. And,
yeah, and, you know, I mean, Japan money versus, you know, the money that these guys are talking, or indie shows, whatever. It was just like, dude, I could go over to Japan for 2 weeks and then not work for 6 months. You know, my bills were so low at the time, you know, in a small little apartment with not much overhead. And I was just like, hey, if Paul calls me, he calls me, whatever. In fact, when he did call me, the first time I didn't go because he wanted me to work Mikey Whipwreck. I didn't like what he wanted, you know, it was to get Mikey over and just take a look at me and probably do Sabu a favor by bringing me in. So I was like, I'll pass. And then, eventually, you know, something worked out and I went up there.
Yeah,
Baba, by the way, in All Japan, that part of my career, which was a really substantial part, for me of my career, almost totally forgotten by almost all the, wrestling.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, I remember
when they go through my path. A lot of them think I started in '96 with ECW, but Baba was so cool. I started in '93, worked in All Japan till '97. Giant Baba had passed away. I did like one tour for his wife, and everything kind of fell apart. But he was so cool. He was like, "How much money do you want? How many weeks a year do you want?"
Wow, he gave you that type of a deal.
Yeah, which doesn't mean for sure I'm going to get exactly what I say, you know. But yeah, you know, first time, it was like they wanted me more than I wanted them because my first time I went for the 2-weeker, which was February, and I was so traumatized by the tour that I didn't want to go back. Like I love the style, but the 10-hour bus rides, I couldn't eat any of the food. I was just homesick, you know, and I didn't even know how to fly back then. I mean, I was 22 years old and I was just a little kid, really, looking back.
It's funny.
Dory would call me, you know, a few months later, hey, they went off, you're ready to go back. And I was like, no, give me some more time. And the whole year went by. And then I did the next February tour because that was the shortest tour of the year. I couldn't handle doing 5 weeks over there. You know, I must have lost 10, 15 pounds in the 2 weeks.
Did you ever get used to it?
I did. I got used to it enough, you know, to where as my star was rising, I'd gone to them a few times. Hey, I want some more money. They were always really cool. Eventually, I was like, look, you know, I want to be able to just count on this or whatever. And that's, you know, like, yeah, how much do you want, you know, and this much a week. And then how many tours, you know, and I was like, I just want to do, I was like, I can't remember exactly, but it was like maybe, seems like 8 to 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of vague, you know, but it was like maybe like three tours was a year was, you know, it was going to work good for me there. Maybe four, that'd be heavy, but I couldn't understand those guys. Johnny Ace was one of them, you know, Patriot, Doug Furness, Danny Crawford. Those guys, man, they would come home sometimes for a week and a half, sometimes for 3 weeks, and bam, just turn around and go right back. They it was like they lived over there. It was like a whole other world that doesn't even exist and didn't exist to the fans that only watch American wrestling.
You know, it's interesting because our careers were very, very similar. I was over in Japan the same time as you were. I started there in 94, and I was one of those guys. I used to go every 2 weeks for a whole year. I think I did 12 tours or whatever it was. But I remember I saw a match of you and Danny Crawford, Phil LaFon. It was a single match. And it was just an amazing match. Do you remember that match by chance?
I'll always remember that. It was very pivotal. It was very pivotal for me because I learned so much from that match. We all called him, well, Abdullah the Butcher we called Danny Crawford the Master, you know, which kind of, a lot of us would call him that too. But he was known for really, you know, getting the most out of every match. And I just learned so much, you know, about not just doing moves, but placing them in the right order so that to get the best reaction, a growing reaction out of the crowd, you know, to finally hit that crescendo. Can I use a musical term? I don't qualify. I'm not a crescendo.
That works.
But to hear that boom, you know, it was good. It was really good.
And, you know, I remember.
I always remember that match, and I would love to someday run into Danny Crawford and thank him for that. And by the way, weren't your tours mostly like one match or no?
No, our tours were usually, I mean, there was some that were one match, but when I was with WAR, we would do 2 weeks, mostly 2 weeks. Once in a while, it'd be a 3 week, once in a while, it'd be 1 week. But it was 2 weeks on the average, which were, like you said, you would have loved working with WAR because that's all we basically did.
Yeah, eventually it was all right for me. But man, for my first tour, I remember like Things were a lot different back then.
I mean,
now Japan has become a very Americanized, but back then everybody, and it's going to sound stereotypical, but screw it, it's true. Everybody wore the exact same clothes. Like when you would go out in Tokyo, like we stayed in the Ginza area.
Yeah.
And you wait for the signal to change to cross the busy street. Everybody moves in unison, like the robots. All the men have the exact same suit on. All the women are dressed the same. They all have the exact same color hair.
Yeah,
move the same. It was crazy. And then like after being there for like 10, 11 days or something, I saw one girl probably in her Roppongi that maybe was different. Like she dyed her hair. It was like, oh my God, oh my, look at that girl.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing too about it is that there was no cell phones or computers. I remember we used to have to go buy international phone cards where you'd have to find an international phone and put like this credit card into the phone to call home, and it would click down credits. And when you ran out of credits, you threw the card away and put another one in. Like, how crazy is that? It was only 20 years ago, but it seems like it might as well have been 100.
Bobby Duncan Jr. is on the phone, international phone, which is in the lobby, because like you said, we had to do that. And so we could hear him because we're in the lobby, and he might have had a little bit of alcohol, but the phone would echo this particular night anyway, and you'd get the feedback, and it would repeat what you just said. Bobby got into a fight with himself on the phone in front of everybody. It was the funniest thing ever, because he calls home. He's like, hello? Hello? Who's this? Who's this? Hey, hey, where's my wife? Where's my wife? He goes, you tell her to have the divorce papers ready when I get home. And he hung up the phone. He was really upset.
Yes, good old Bobby Duncan Jr., man. Well, I mean, we talked about parallel careers. I mean, you went to ECW. I followed you soon afterwards. I called Paulie for a year, by the way. I talked to Paulie's roommate, Dave, which was Paulie. Just, it's like, yes, this is Paulie's roommate, Dave. We'll call back later. I talked to him where he said he had Jimmy Snuka on the other line. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. So I never heard from him for a year. I finally get to go. The first guy I ever meet when I knock on the hotel room that I'm sharing the room with, and it's you. You had just started like about a week before that. We got there at about the same time. You remember?
Yeah, because I thought you were there before me, because I remember that last show at the Queen's Battalion.
Yes.
Before they moved to the Elks Lodge. And then you and I think we might have even tagged.
I think my first match ever in ECW, we were a tag against the Eliminators at the,
At the Slam Arena.
Yeah, the Slam Arena. And then we worked against each other in the Queen's Elk Lodge. Which that was the first. Yeah, that's the first time we ever worked. But then
we worked each other at the
Queen's.
No, it was that temple, Lulu Temple.
Yeah, we worked there quite a few.
You did that drop kick off the apron or off the turnbuckle. I was on the apron.
Uh-huh.
Bam! You hit me, and I did a backflip. Do you remember this?
I do.
I did a backflip and smashed three quarters of a backflip to from the kick. And when I landed, my knee hit so hard and hyperextended. And the next day was the very first time that I would ever wrestle after taking a pain pill. Thank you, Pitbulls.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
My knee was so messed up, and I didn't want anybody to know. And I was limping. I couldn't straighten it out. It was really bad. It was like it affected my walk and everything. The next night was in Philly. And the Pitbulls, oh, here, just take this, bro. Here, wash it down with this. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Which became a standard, that in the dressing room that several boys followed and several did not. But that was, that was my introduction to that.
Yeah,
and,
I remember.
And that night in Philly, where I was really concerned about my knee, I wrestled Sabu, and I limped out to the ring, but I was hoping nobody would notice. And he went right for my leg right away, but the ring had broke.
Uh-huh.
The famous night.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The ring had broke a couple times. They tried to fix it. The people had to wait forever. It was over 100 degrees in the building. Kimona Wanalea was dancing.
Paulie Center.
Me and Steph, we started our match. Bam, the top rope broke right off the bat. And he didn't even care. He did his chair, top rope, stood on the broken rope that's hanging there like a jump rope. And they did his moonsault, and I was like, oh, it's on.
Yeah, the ring broke, so the fans were waiting so long that Paul sent Kimono Wanalea, this really hot Asian valet, up to the little crow's nest area to do a strip tease while the people were waiting.
EC Dub.
And I remember I was standing next to Terry Gordy, and he goes, "I ain't never seen nothing like this at no wrestling match before." But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, people talk about ECW with such great memories. I mean, with great respect, and it was almost like the golden age. Being at ECW, it really was kind of an us versus them mentality. It really was an interesting place to be because it was like a bunch of rebels. I noticed that right away when I got there. Did you feel that being there, that it was kind of a real closed society, almost you know, we're better than the world type of a vibe?
Well, yes. And I think, you know, prospectively, anybody that really stands by their own standards, mm-hmm. and really doesn't need to conform, I think that person, you could call them a rebel, but prospectively, they do think they're better than anybody else. At least they're doing what's best for them. And I'm one of those nonconformists. Like, I don't need
That's right.
somebody else to tell me what I should be thinking. I hate that. That's one of my worst frustrations throughout the day, is having all of my actions and thoughts and every efforts second guess. Why do you do that? Why don't you do it this way? I'm one of a kind. Everybody knows that. Like, you introduced me, a unique individual. Yeah, this band of renegades, ECW, was a bunch of nonconformists, and that's what the whole spirit of ECW was. That's why so many of us sacrificed going to other companies, because we wanted to stay there and always be able to do it by our own way, you know? Like,
yes.
This is the way we want to be seen. And, you know, I mean, it never could have grown to as big as was necessary to consider it making it to the top.
Well, I mean, you know, because I think if it would have made it to the top, it would have kind of changed the concept of what the company was. Because, I mean, talking about being in Japan in the mid-90s from 93, 94, 95, ECW was the place to be if you read the Japanese magazines. Like, there was so much coverage about ECW, and WWE at the time was kind of a little bit boring, and WCW was kind of boring, you know, kind of the same old, but ECW was a whole new thing and very much a pioneer. You know, setting the standard for hardcore matches. And like you said, a guy like Sabu could go there and do whatever he wanted and not get, you know, well, that's not good psychology, because the psychology of ECW was just be yourself.
Yeah, which, that's my T-shirt line right there. You just,
well, I mean, for you too.
A side project that is exactly what you said. It's platypieproductions.org. And at this point, like, I don't even know if anyone else is going to get it, or if they're going to really care about it. But I love these shirts, you know. And maybe that's, one of them says on the back, be yourself. Everyone else is taken. You know?
That's right, yeah. Well, and another cool thing, too, is that I thought Paul Heyman, Paulie Dangerously, which is, well, he was Paul Heyman at the time, he was a great motivator. And I'll never forget, like, you know, I was making, I don't know, $250 a match or maybe $500 a match, but it wasn't about the money. He would stand by the curtain when you came through and be like, "You, sir, are one of the finest competitors I've ever had the pleasure of working with, and I will work with you for as long as you like." Like, he would make you feel, like, special, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And with me and Sabu, like, we always felt like we were on a total different level with him, and he treated us like that. One time at the Greyhound Center in Boston, he goes, "I'm going to have a meeting today. I'm going to tell everybody that it's mandatory and that they have to be there. You and Sabu don't have to be there." Which, of course, and then Sabu would tell me, "Well, he's doing that to manipulate, because the dressing room, then they're going to say, 'Hey, where's Robin Sabu?' And then, you know, it's going to get heat on us." And he's going to say, "I don't know. I haven't seen them." And,
of course.
And he was explaining Paul to me at the time.
Who were some of your favorite guys to work with there, besides obviously Sabu? You guys had great chemistry. Who else did you like working with there?
Oh, my God. There was So many. Like the bigger guys, man, I was marking out to be able to wrestle with Bam Bam Bigelow or One Man Gang. You know, Kamala, when I had the belt for 2 years, the TV belt, we were bringing people in from Japan, other groups, whatever, just to challenge for the title. It was so fun. I liked wrestling with smaller guys too, Spike, Little Guido. You know, and that was, I was really learning the craft and learning to try to consistently put out the best matches I could, which my following, you know, would swear they were the best matches on the card and chant my name from beginning to end. At times, you know, when things were really rocking there, it was awesome. And, you know, I'm going to have a completely different match with Little Guido than I am with One Man Gang, but that was what I understood was what it was about. You know, you got what you bring to the table, and you mix that up, you know, and they bring to the table, and bam, that's what keeps it interesting.
Is that where you started the RVD double thumb point to your head, Rob Van Dam?
Yeah, I mean, and also, of course, I have to mention Jerry Lynn. I have my
Jerry's
my career with Jerry Lynn.
So Jerry's very underrated as a performer, I find.
Well, that's it. You know, the first time I wrestled him in Philly, Paul and Sabu were like, okay, this should be a quick match, like 8 minutes, you know, it was like for TV or whatever. I was like, wait a second, can I have longer? Take as long as you want. You know, that was Paul.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, I don't know, I didn't even know Jerry really. I just knew he was a friend of Scotty Riggs, and Scotty was a friend of mine. But, you know, I was like, I don't know, I like him, and I think, you know, maybe we can do something. And bam, had first match, we had 20 minutes. And my outfit was ripped, my nose was bloody, my hair was all over the place, you know, and I finally beat him and the crowd went nuts. I was like, dude, that's what I want to give. That's why I have this connection with these hardcore fans, because they want what I want to give them, and it works. And bam, it was such a good fit for me. But to answer your question about the thumbs, during this time, I was a heel. I came in as a heel because Sabu was like God there, and I was wrestling against him.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be Sabu, Sabu. And then I'd do some jumping, spinning kick, bam, something. I'd say, what? Oh, don't you mean? And I'd point my thumbs at myself, you know,
yeah.
RVD. I had no idea that I was being so original, that I was creating a taunt that no one else can do without doing the RVD thumbs. Until I returned to Japan. I can't remember what company it was for, but I was outside of the Budokan, and we were going up alongside the big line of Japanese fans, and the bus was pulling up along the fans to get to the arena, and I was looking out the window waving at some fans, and they started doing the thumbs to me, and I go, oh, that's my move. I had no idea that represented RVD till that moment.
Did you get a great, I mean, obviously in ECW, you were one of the top stars, getting huge reactions. Did you get a lot of great reactions in All Japan as well? Were people really getting behind you there?
Yeah, they always did. And then it was a growing thing. You know, I got to a point where I reached what the Japanese fans said was a senpai. And that was when I returned with WWE. And that was, I think that might even, no, that wouldn't have been. But that was a big show. It was at the Budokan. I got to put over Luther Reigns, which was awesome to return. But yeah, I mean, you know, I started out, you know, really green and had to prove myself. And like, so the wrestlers like Kawada and some of those guys, they would just kick the crap out of me.
Yeah, tough guys.
But, yeah, you know, and I had to learn to give it back, you know, and to take it. And I understood that's the way they wanted it, you know. But, you know, first I had a kimono, which they wear in their bathroom or something. And I'm wearing it out to the ring, like, because I think it looks like a karate gi, you know. And I got a black belt tied around this bathrobe, coming out to the ring barefoot, saying I'm a martial artist. So, and I'm just a green 22-year-old kid. So, yeah, you know, I was pretty much asking for them to kick the crap out of me and to really test me. And the fans, you know, really took to me. I was the only guy in All Japan that was, you know, obviously the only guy doing backflips off the guardrail.
Right.
But even, you know, that style at all, they weren't really doing it. And then I helped, I think, influence a lot of the young boys. They all started patterning after my style, diving to the floor, doing, you know, moves that made the crowd go, ooh. Because everyone else was, they were all really, there were some really, really big guys in that company, and then there was some in between, but and then of course when I wouldn't be on a tour, and they'd do a tour without me, then I would hear the young boys are stealing my moves.
Well, and that's the way that it always was in Japan, especially for All Japan, because that was a big man's territory. Like you said, there was much more just kind of kicking and punching and power bombs on your head rather than really cool, nice aerial type moves.
Yeah. Yeah, so I helped kind of, I think, bring that to All Japan. I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I mean, I stood out, and the fans always took to me in a growing way. And, you know, I love when I get a chance to go back there and see the fans.
Who came up with the name Rob Van Dam?
Ron Slinker.
Okay, because you look like Van Dam, or because you did a lot of kicks?
Yeah, I think it's probably the looks, and I was 21 at this time when I went to Florida to wrestle. So this was really early in my career, 92, and is it 92 or 91? I think it's 92. I'd finished up at USWA.
Mm-hmm.
It's 91. Yeah, I turned 21 in Jamaica on a tour with Ron Slinker, just weeks into being crowned Mr. Rob Van Dam. So I went down there, and at that time of my career, I was taught by Sheik and Sabu, it's you know, get out there, get booked as much as you can, learn as much as you can. Whereas other guys that were like, I've been told I should be a wrestler because I have a cool look or I have a cool name. I was told that doesn't matter, so you could call me whatever every night. The Sheik would book me as different formations of my shoot last name, or Rod Zad or Robbie Z I wrestled as, or the Polish Prince. He always wanted to make me Polish. I was like, come on, man. Come on, Sheik. He said, you know how much money I made with Igor? Or Igor or whatever.
The mighty Igor.
it was during that time. So, you know, Slinker said, you're Rob Van Dam. I was like, all right, cool. And it stuck.
It's much better than the Polish Prince, I'd have to say.
I was like, man, I want people to like me. I got dimples. I'm good looking. I want to get the girls, you know, and look at Igor. He's the big old, big hunchback guy. And I'm like, how do you think, what, you want to associate me with that and make money? But not that I argued with him, but I was always like, oh, man. But, yeah, El Snow. I worked for El Snow at that time. So my first few matches, me and Dango were the Flying Tigers. It was
nice.
It was about getting work and learning.
Rob Van Dam, RVD, one of a kind. Too much to talk about to limit to just one conversation. So we'll pick it back up with Rob on Friday. Yeah, thank God it's Friday. You know the drill. We're not done yet. We got more. I'm still going to be taking your phone calls and answering your questions today. So keep an eye on the Twitter so you don't miss your chance to call in at Talk is Jericho. That's coming up soon.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, it's time to go to the phones. As always, I posted the number on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho. You never know when your chance will come to call in and ask whatever you want to ask. And starting it off, we got Ruben calling from Los Angeles, California. What's going on, Ruben?
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing good, man. A huge fan of the show and
thank you.
Huge fan of you personally.
Thanks, man.
So very, very excited to talk to you. Real quickly, I want to know, obviously everyone knows you as, Y2J, Chris Jericho, the Ayatollah of rock and roll and all that stuff, but since kind of, dipping in and out of WWE, you've done a lot, with Fozzy, Dancing with the Stars, you've hosted a couple TV shows, now you're doing a podcast, what do you want to be known as outside of just a wrestler?
Well, I mean, I think over the last... geez, probably the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, I've always thought of myself as an entertainer first, wrestler second. That's how I kind of made it into the business in the first place, was because I knew I would never be the biggest guy on the show, but I could have the biggest character and the biggest personality and the biggest charisma. So I always looked at it from that viewpoint of being a character. So yes, and obviously most people know me first and foremost from wrestling, but over the last 3 or 4 years, it's been less wrestling and, more Fozzy and, like you said, the outside projects and stuff. And I don't really care how people remember me, as long as they remember me as somebody that entertained them. whether it's wrestling or music, or they enjoy my book, or they enjoy this show, or you know, all the TV stuff that I've done, the acting stuff that I've done. I think in this day and age, the idea is to brand yourself as much as possible so that you can appeal to more people. And you don't have to be stuck in a box like you used to, you know, years ago. I am Chris Jericho. I do a lot of different things, and I'm always going to do a lot of different things, and I always have done a lot of different things. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've had the longevity that I have, and why I have such a great and loyal fan base that follow me to all the different things that I do, because they know if my name is on it, that they're probably going to be entertained.
Got you.
Yeah, so that's basically it. It's Chris Jericho, the brand. I just want to be remembered as someone that entertains you, man. Do I entertain you, Ruben? Huh? Do I entertain you?
You do, very much.
Huh?
Very much.
Cool, man.
I love everything that you've done so far. You know, I mean, I've read both your books, and I'm excited for your next book.
Thanks for listening, dude.
No problem. Thank you, man.
And next on the line, we have Suwada calling from Canada, London, Ontario, to be exact. Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am doing amazing. How is it up there? Is it cold in London right now?
Oh, yeah. There's snow.
Welcome to Canada, right? What's your question, yeah. Suwada? What would you like to know?
I know you have a matching tattoo with M Shadows, and I was wondering if you would ever get one with Sin Yates, and what would it be?
Well, the reason why Shadows and I have one is because we became friends a few years ago, and got to become really cool friends because we both like this kind of obscure German power metal band called Helloween. So I think one day we were hanging, I was like, dude, let's get Helloween tattoos. So he came and saw our Fozzy show when we played the Roxy in LA, and then brought his tattoo artist. So afterwards in the dressing room, we got the matching Helloween pumpkins. And with Gates, I'm not sure what we'd get. We always like having a good time, maybe a Grey Goose bottle tattooed on there somewhere. Or maybe some kind of 70s disco tattoo. We always talk about that. Actually, his dad played guitar on the song Car Wash. So whenever I hear Car Wash, yeah, I always call him up. So maybe we get some kind of a Car Wash tattoo. Maybe a car made out of a Grey Goose bottle getting washed. That would kind of sum up the relationships that we have. But the funny thing about the Avenged guys is they're running out of space to get tattooed. Like, I had this whole arm to choose from. And Shad's had this little weak corner on kind of his forearm, and we were running out of time, and mine took a little while, and then his, the guy just went like, got it done. I guess when you have 10,000 tattoos, one more really isn't going to make much of a difference. So there you go. Now, if you could have a tattoo with Sinister Gaze, what would you get?
Oh my gosh, I do not know.
That's a death really bat? Impressive. Maybe a death bat with his face on it, kind of, or something?
maybe just music notes or something simple. I don't know.
Yeah, you have to think about that because you never know. You might one day get the chance to get a tattoo with Sin Gates. You need to have an idea. So thank you so much for listening to the show. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
No problem. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for hitting that download button and linking to Amazon through the Talk is Jericho page at podcastone.com. Every time you do your shopping that way, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show so I can keep bringing you the Pot of Thunder twice a week for free. I mean, we got lots of costs, long distance calls, headphones. I got headphones on here. I got a windscreen on the microphone. These things aren't cheap. You need to pay for them somehow. So when you go to Amazon through the Talk is Jericho page, you do your little part. If you like what you're hearing, as a matter of fact, tell your friends about us. Tell them to check out the show. Tell them to never miss this show every Wednesday, every Friday. You can even hit that subscribe button at iTunes so you never miss an episode. These things are coming at you quickly. Boom, bam, boom. If you subscribe, it'll show up on your device every single time we go live. So coming up on Friday, part two of my amazing conversation with Rob Van Dam. Looking forward to that. So you stay cool, stay hungry, stay hard. God bless you all. We'll see you on Friday. Yeah, boy!
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Daddy, where do babies come from? Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to Geico, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley-Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.
Have major life expenses? Using a credit card can cost you an arm and a leg in interest and fees. Break up with bad credit card debt and check out a SoFi personal loan. With low fixed interest rates and absolutely no fees, a personal loan could be a great way to consolidate your hard-to-pay-off, high-interest credit card debt. A SoFi personal loan can also be used for home improvement projects, weddings, travel, moving costs, emergency expenses, whatever life throws your way, with funding ranging from $5,000 to $100,000. With a single fixed monthly payment and no fees, a SoFi personal loan is simply a smarter way to pay compared to high-interest credit cards. View your rate in 60 seconds without affecting your credit score at SoFi.com/podcast. That's SoFi.com/podcast. And get your money right. Loans originated by SoFi Bank N.A., member FDIC. Terms and conditions apply. NMLS 6968968891.
It used to be hard to find the exact auto parts you needed, and that meant spending a lot of time at swap meets. It's a different game now when you can order exactly what you need from eBay Motors. They have 122 million parts, so you can always find the right fitment. Spend less time searching and more time building with the eBay Motors app, or visit ebaymotors.com. Let's ride.